joking, yo, town. Get up and get down. Late night, mum, where's the late crown?
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Today on Wings, Feminist Foreign Policy, The Next Generation.
Anything that is under the banner of feminism is really about challenging hierarchies and aiming for social and political transformation.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Back in 2011, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was lauded in The Guardian for proving that a feminist foreign policy is possible. She took up issues ranging from including women in negotiations with the Taliban to reproductive rights and smokeless cookstoves and creation of a UN Secretariat for Women. But in Obama's second term, Clinton was replaced. A decade later, feminist foreign policy is widely discussed, and some definitions go well beyond what Hillary Clinton tried to change. Sophia Vavarutzos reports.
I'm Sophia Vavarutzos. Today on Wings, I'll sit down with Jennifer Thompson from the University of Bath, Siham Rayal from Oxfam Canada, and Marissa Conway from the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy. All three are feminist foreign policy experts coming from different perspectives and experiences within the field. The first thing the experts said I should know is that because feminist foreign policy is such a new topic, different folks define it differently. Marissa Conway, founder and director of the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy, notes that there are generally two definitions, depending on the context.
There are two different working definitions of feminist foreign policy, and I think they're actually quite different. One is what you see with governments, sort of the state-defined feminist foreign policy framework, and the other is what feminist activists and nonprofit organizations and civil society push. I definitely fit in that feminist activist camp.
Marissa Conway from the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy. Next, the experts go through each definition.
The state-generated, state-sponsored feminist foreign policy is a very intentional focus on gender equality and kind of mainstreaming women's rights into all different aspects of foreign policy.
If we think about other terminology that we might hear in international politics in relation to human rights or women's rights or the rights of children, etc., normally we're hearing a reference to something which is backed up in, for example, international law or a specific international treaty that states have negotiated, or perhaps a resolution that the United Nations have passed or the United Nations Security Council have passed.
Jennifer Thompson from the University of Bath holds a PhD and conducts research about feminist foreign policy.
When we talk about feminist foreign policy, there isn't a foundational document that all of these different states are collectively referring to. There's definitely commonalities across all of these different countries, but they're all largely developing their own policies. So I think it's fair to say that across these very different countries, we would see greater attentiveness to women in positions of leadership, for example, under the umbrella of feminist foreign policy. I think we'd also see, particularly in the case of Sweden, a greater attentiveness to talking about sexual and reproductive health, for example. Other things bring them together. But at the same time, these are very much, you know, independent countries that are developing their own specific foreign policy programs. So there isn't that kind of collective central document or central policy that they're all working from.
So I think when we're thinking about what a feminist foreign policy is, does, looks like, etc., it's something that, you know, should definitely be heterogeneous, right?
Siham Rayal holds a PhD and is the Women's Rights Specialist in Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam Canada. She touches on the definition she sees as a Canadian working in the policy field.
Yes, feminist foreign policy is going to encompass a lot of different broad international and global issues. Certainly, its bandwidth will be limited to issues around global diplomacy, international assistance, consular affairs, right? And obviously within different defense policies and agencies. So when we think about a feminist foreign policy, what we should probably be thinking about is also the ways in which anything that is under the banner of feminism is really about challenging hierarchies and aiming for social and political transformation, right? So we can't be thinking about protecting or advocating for human rights protections for displaced communities and groups, including refugees and IDPs, if we're also not thinking about women and children who are the most impacted. We can't be thinking about them without also thinking about the way that global defense policies impact and destabilize and contribute to conflict, right? And the way that conflict can exacerbate and really escalate refugee issues. So anything that has the label feminist should be about challenging international norms as they exist now.
Siham Rayal, the Women's Rights Specialist in Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam Canada. Circling back to Marissa Conway, founder and executive director of the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy. She says she defines feminist foreign policy by what it could be, rather than what it is now on a bureaucratic level.
My interpretation of feminism, and many feminists I know, understand feminism to be a very intersectional way to look at power dynamics and kind of unpack power inequalities. So this can play out between people, kind of more at local levels, but also these power dynamics between states on sort of the international level, world order, if you will. So the way I perceive the potential of feminist foreign policy is that it's a political framework that really focuses on systems change. So it's not so much about bringing women and gender equality into what already exists, but re-envisioning what could be done better, what new systems we could enact. And this is actively anti-racist. In places like Canada, where there are Indigenous populations that have been oppressed for ages and ages, this is really centering their needs at the forefront of feminist foreign policy, because it's not just about what happens externally from a country, but in order to have a good feminist foreign policy, you also have to incorporate feminist principles domestically and take this work very seriously within a country's own borders. So when I speak of feminist foreign policy, I kind of talk about this feminist potential of foreign policy to come up with a new way of doing politics internationally that is actively focused on equality and doesn't just try and add it on as an afterthought.
Feminist foreign policy is still new and really vague. Experts like Thompson, Rayal, and Conway are working to not only define it, but teach the concepts to governments who have never considered the ideas before. If you look at the definitions of feminist foreign policy that our experts presented, the ideas can only be traced back to about the early 2000s. In October 2000, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution which linked gender equality with peace and security. This is known as UNSCR 1325 and was meant to acknowledge the role of women in conflict resolution, peace negotiations, humanitarian issues, and more. In the resolution, the UN Security Council called on its members to include women in matters of security. This landmark resolution seemed to pick up steam, leading to several reports on the matter. Then in 2003, the United Nations Task Force created a framework to implement it. There were publications put out to engage women and encourage their participation in elections. And then what? Near radio silence. Until 2014, when a government actually used the words feminist foreign policy for the first time. It was Sweden, and that made them a leader in this field, the first government to announce a feminist foreign policy. Marissa Conway, founder and executive director of the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy.
Sweden has been a massive leader in developing feminist foreign policy because they were the first. It kind of positioned them to be the spokes country, if you will, on feminist foreign policy. And I do think their framework it's quite groundbreaking. Sweden's framework is really, really groundbreaking. They were the first country ever in history to put that explicit label of feminism in their foreign policy, in any government policy, which as a term that's been so taboo for so long is a massive step in the right direction, in my opinion. They originally focused their feminist foreign policy around the three R's, so rights, resources, and representation. So that was the rights of women and girls, properly resourcing gender equality initiatives, because we all know nothing happens without proper funding, and women's representation in political leadership, just kind of broadly increasing women's representation. And since a couple other R's have been added on, research is a popular one that people like to use. We need more research and more data on women's rights in foreign policy and how foreign policy impacts women's experiences, this sort of thing, which is a fabulous, fabulous step in the right direction, in my opinion.
Canada was next in 2017. Not quite using the words feminist foreign policy, Canada announced the Feminist International Assistance Policy. It's built on 6 action items. The core action area, gender equality and the empowerment of women and girls. Human dignity, including health, nutrition, education, and humanitarian action. Growth that works for everyone. Environmental and climate action. Inclusive governance. And finally, peace and security. What's the difference between Canada's current efforts and a true feminist foreign policy? Siham Rayal explains.
So Canada hasn't implemented a feminist foreign policy yet. We do have a feminist assistance policy specific to international assistance, but it's obviously within the portfolio of global and foreign affairs. So I know it's developing its feminist foreign policy and hopefully a paper kind of outlining what that policy is going to look like will come out this year. I think it's really critical to rethink. It's good to have a feminist foreign policy framework in place because we really do need to rethink the way that we are framing our international policies and global policies in general, right? And really consider issues of not just inclusivity, but extreme marginalization and social exclusion and the way that our international and foreign policies contribute to that. For example, feminists have long contributed to peace movements, right? And peace building processes. So if you have a feminist foreign policy framework in place, then the hope is that you are aiming and adhere to principles of demilitarization and arms control with the aim of eventually reducing the number of arms that any one country can hold, because we know that they do contribute significantly to destabilizing countries, no matter, you know, what conditions they were in to begin with. But also, if we're going to be really and truly breaking down global hierarchies where you have centers of economic power and political power concentrated in Western countries, then really, how can you be promoting any kind of feminist foreign policy, right? If we've replaced actively colonizing other countries. One system of domination and aggression with another. So when we think about a feminist foreign policy framework here in Canada, we need to be thinking about these issues. We need to be thinking about not contributing to reinforcing international norms that really maintain systems of exclusion and marginalization. And that applies significantly to our own context, particularly when it comes to Indigenous communities. If we're going to be promoting decolonization and human rights protections globally, we need to be thinking about how we're going to be doing that at home here, right? So there's a greater synergy, I think, with a feminist foreign policy, or a greater opportunity with a feminist foreign policy to break down these barriers between what domestic and international affairs looks like.
Siham Rayal is the Women's Rights Specialist in Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam Canada. You're listening to Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today, we're exploring feminist foreign policy across the globe. In 2018, the United Kingdom's Labour Party launched their feminist development policy, and the UK Women's Equality Party voted to adopt a feminist foreign policy. In 2019, France, Luxembourg, and Mexico announced their intentions to develop feminist foreign policies. In 2020, Mexico followed up and officially launched their policy.
I think Mexico has also done a really wonderful job of breaking down what they actually mean when they say they're adopting a feminist foreign policy. And this is a super important part because not many countries have actually done this.
Marissa Conway from the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy.
There are more countries that are committing to a feminist foreign policy, but not as many of them have actually written out what that means, what's going to change, how are they going to monitor this, how are they going to track progress. Sweden and Canada and Mexico have done a fabulous job on this, but other countries that have engaged with this idea, like the US, they tried to pass a bill in the House. The UK, there are a couple political parties, but to date, nothing tangible has necessarily come out of this. There haven't been any specific commitments and frameworks that can actually be implemented. It's sort of more of a rhetorical interest in adopting this.
Most recently, at this year's United Nations Generation Equality Forum, Libya has committed to a feminist foreign policy, joining a new global partner network meant to bring governments together in creating feminist foreign policies. What's the difference between countries with feminist foreign policies and those without? The question is especially potent given the recent crises we've experienced as a global society, COVID-19, women's rights in Afghanistan, and more. Jennifer Thompson stressed that a proper feminist foreign policy would have a two-pronged impact.
It was the question of, well, what would it do for the country that is implementing or developing that foreign policy? And then what would it do for the country where that foreign policy is being implemented? So what does having a feminist foreign policy mean for women in Sweden, for example? And what does it mean for the women in the countries around the world where Swedish foreign policy and perhaps Swedish aid money is at work? For the domestic context, I think Mexico is a good example of this. Mexico's feminist foreign policy talks quite a lot about improving the level of women in Mexican diplomacy and in the Mexican Foreign Service. So really trying to improve the ratio between male and female employees in that sector of the Mexican government. So I think it has the potential for improving that particular domestic context. But I think it's also about, well, what is that policy actually doing in practice? What is it doing out in the field, in the international context where these countries are working? And I think that's a more difficult question. And I think we know less about that at the moment because the various countries that have adopted these foreign policies are still really in the early stages of doing so. We're still talking about the last couple of years for most of these countries, slightly longer for Sweden and slightly longer for Canada as well, who've had a feminist international assistance policy for a good few years at this point. But I think there's still less research in terms of, well, what are these policies actually doing on the ground? What change are they actually implementing in the various international contexts in which they work? And I think for me, that's the kind of crux of defining them as feminist in the first place? You know, if these policies are going out into the world and having a demonstrable, concrete impact on women and girls in the various countries, for example, where Canada works, then yes, I think they merit the term feminist. But if they're not having that direct impact on the ground, then I think we have to question, well, what's feminist about them in the first place if they're not having any impact?
For Siham Rayal, the recent crises Canada experienced showed where improvements could be made in their policies.
You've seen the differential impact that this pandemic has had on women. And a huge part of that has had to do with historical inequalities, including gender and race, right? Because having a strong intersectional perspective and lens on these issues is really critical. So we had a care crisis, or the care crisis kind of really came together during this pandemic, even in Canada, right? All of a sudden, we realized how many households relied on care, on the care that women provided in their households. All of a sudden, we're talking a lot more about how working women had double or triple the responsibilities within their households when we moved to working from home. And if you just look at the global care economy in general, over 70% of care responsibilities are borne by women globally. So when you had economic shutdowns and lockdowns as a consequence of the spread of this virus, a lot of those responsibilities were magnified. You know, if you had family members that were in hospital, if all of a sudden men were working from home and you had to find a way to work from home that kept the children or whoever needed care away from any sort of at-home work environment. So I think it really magnified an issue that we knew had already existed, right? There are a whole host of issues that this pandemic has really heightened and became another layer of this crisis. One of those that we also at Oxfam talk a lot about is the shadow pandemic, which is the crisis of domestic violence, sexual and gender-based violence, but domestic violence also very specifically, and how cases of domestic violence had gone up in the first global lockdown, which was in the spring to the summer of March 2020, which really just gives you an indication of the extreme forms of exclusion and marginalization that women were facing in wealthier countries as well as in low and middle income countries. And, you know, these kinds of issues were issues that feminists and women's rights activists had always been pointing to. And I think with feminist leadership, at the very least, there would have been two things. One, there would have been an understanding early on of the linkages between the two and the need to strengthen resources for organizations or government agencies to be able to support these kinds of households and these kinds of communities that we knew were going to be experiencing this pandemic radically different than other communities, right? And so I'm talking about Indigenous and racialized women, because those in Canada specifically made up the bulk of those that were experiencing domestic violence here. So I think the response would have been different because the perspective would have been different. And, you know, this is why it's really critical to have feminist leadership, which doesn't just include, you know, women leading, even though that's vital. You need women in critical ministries. You need women at the very top to be able to draw these linkages between public policy and you know, the services that are needed, but also to highlight the issue in general and to say that this is a societal problem. It isn't just an individual or household issue, that particular household just has a very unique problem. No, society as a whole has allowed these attitudes and behaviors to fester. So I think feminist leadership would have radically changed the way that we had experienced and had responded to this pandemic. So we'll see what ambitions Canada will lay out within its feminist foreign policy framework or document. I don't know what to call it yet. We'll all know what to call it when it comes out. But if it's anything like its international assistance policy, its mandate and its ambition seem to be quite broad. But obviously delivering on that is going to have to take a huge institutional shift that includes defense, diplomacy, and development. How are you going to find coherency among all of these under a feminist framework?
Siham Rayal is the Women's Rights Specialist in Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam Canada. One of the key pillars in feminist foreign policy at the moment is representation of women in government and the ability for more women to take part in feminist foreign policy decisions. But putting more women into a system designed to oppress them without implementing proper support might not achieve as much as governments think. On this, the experts all seem to share similar views. For Marissa Conway, founder and director of the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy, the true impact of feminist foreign policy won't be felt for a long time, because it won't be until systems change, not just policies, that feminist foreign policy is actually achieving its goal.
So I think the feminist foreign policy we see now as implemented by governments does focus on bringing women into what exists, into the patriarchal systems that govern foreign policy and political institutions as we know them. And the potential of feminist foreign policy that I get super excited about is completely rethinking how we even do foreign policy to start. So rather than trying to bring in marginalized groups and communities into these very narrow-minded, very patriarchal spaces, it's actually just kind of redoing everything completely and thinking about what it could mean to have a very holistic approach to foreign policy that is focused on what people need to have a secure, happy, healthy life. And so quickly that gets you away from the military, it gets you away from abstract things and grounds it very fast in the actual needs of people who have typically been excluded from policy.
With any movement, but especially those where there would be large changes in the way society operates, momentum and resources are needed. Conway noted funding as one area feminist foreign policy lacks around the globe.
One of the things I see, and different feminists have different takes on this, but I look at defense budgets and just think, if we weren't investing in all these weapons that just don't need more money poured into them, nuclear weapons being a big one, we would have a lot more funding to build out systems and infrastructure that actually take care of the everyday needs of people in a society. In the UK, for example, the NHS is struggling with funding cuts. Austerity measures make it really tough for single mothers, for example. And yet the government has just decided to invest all this money into building new nuclear weapons. We already have enough. There is actually no reason to build more. And I think if the political will was there, it would be very easy to fund this type of activity. But oh gosh, I'm writing this piece on nuclear weapons right now, so my mind is just very heavily in this field. But people in power don't want to give up power, and nuclear weapons symbolize power. So it's a very difficult ask to say, hey, divert money away from this thing that makes you feel like a big man in the international world to something that is going to help out, you know, people who are very vulnerable. If the will was there, it would happen. So it's not a matter of resourcing, it's a matter of political will.
Bianca Mugyenyi from the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute wrote an analysis of the Canadian 2021 budget, which backs up Conway's experience with funding. Despite committing $30 billion to launch a national childcare program, the analysis notes that 10 times the amount of funding for climate change initiatives is being directed to the military. As Conway says, this is something that actually counteracts the intentions of feminist foreign policy. Conway noted that Canada's situation is not unique. Without committing money to change systems in place, feminist foreign policy will not be able to progress as it should. If and when proper funding is in place, organizations like Conway's and Rayal's would be able to focus more attention on building momentum through education. Though feminist foreign policy is making progress, experts agree that there is more to do. With the climate crisis and COVID-19 recovery ongoing and political tensions rising around the world, are we in a battle against the clock? How much longer can governments use the same strategies to deal with these issues? The next few years will be telling. Today you heard from Jennifer Thompson from the University of Bath, Siham Rayal from Oxfam Canada, and Marissa Conway from the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy. Research was included from the United Nations Security Council's website, the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy and the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. I'm Sophia Vavaroutsos, reporting for Wings.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit wingsradio.org/WordPress or facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, who hosts fortnightly salons with feminist activists and thinkers on the subject of the gift economy at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer, Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.com.